Hey, this is Dominic Romeo from Integrity and 8389 Recordings, and you're listening to Toilet of Hell Radio.
You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.
Greetings, friends. It's your boy Joe Thrashenkill, and I am stoked that you're joining us for this episode of Toilet Radio. We're about to have a very special guest on the show. This is a straight interview episode with a guy that I tried my best to not fanboy all over too hard, and I didn't succeed. Sorry about that. We've got Dom Romeo on the show today, and if that name isn't immediately familiar, let me try to jog your memory. See, Dom is the founder and sole proprietor of A389 Records, one of the finest heavy music labels in the country. He's also the creative linchpin of the long-running hardcore band Pulling Teeth, and perhaps the coolest thing he does, and what we spend most of the time talking about on this episode, is play guitar in Integrity. If you haven't yet heard Howling for the Nightmare Shall Consume, that's the latest record from Integrity, you are sorely missing out. Hands down, the best record of 2017 so far. I'm just fucking blown away by it. So, it's super rad that we got to chat with Dom and really pick his brain about writing this album and working with Dwid. So we're going to open this show with a song from that record, and then we're going to close it with a track from Pulling Teeth. A389 is releasing a 10-year anniversary remaster of Martyr Immortal. So we're going to listen to With Avarice, the opening track from that record, before you can hear it anywhere else. Also, Pulling Teeth is going to be playing a single reunion show at This Is Hardcore in Philly on Friday, July 28th. So if you're in the area, do not miss out. You'll get a chance to see Dom alongside Bloodlit and Young in the Way and a whole ton of other great bands. All right, let's get right into this one. Prepare your butts for new Integrity. This is Die With Your Boots On.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Toilet Hell Radio Show. I'm Joe Thrashenkill. With me, I've got my co-host, 365 Days of Horror, and we're here with a very special guest. Dom, how are you doing today?
Well, how are you?
Doing pretty well. Thanks so much for joining us on the show today. You must be an exceptionally busy guy with all of these things in the air.
Yeah, I also have a day job and 3 kids that are under 7. It's a little hectic, but I make it work.
Three kids? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. This year they're 3, 5, and 7, so it's just absolute chaos all the time.
That's incredible. I one of my favorite things about following A389 Records on social media is how you post pictures of your daughter with all the merch going out.
Yep. They're always around. They think they're helping, and I guess you know they're definitely helping, keeping it entertaining. It's fun to do, but yeah, it's cool. I like to. If people wonder why things take too long, I like to kind of show them a window into what's actually happening, so they don't really get on my case and be like, "Why isn't my thing shipped? Or what's going on?" You know. And
when do you sleep?
Been lucky. You know, just question for the ages. Wherever I can, just grab a little bit here and there. Make it work.
So how long have you been doing A389, Rao?
A389 started in 13 years this year, right? Yeah, 13.
That's awesome. So what was the impetus for starting up the label?
I did a lot of labels growing up for fun. I was into like releasing my own records and just, you know, not really having to answer to anybody was always the MO. And around 2004, when I started doing it, I was in a punk band called the Slumlords, and we were playing a lot, doing a lot of festivals, just traveling around a lot. And I thought it'd be a good opportunity to release bands from Baltimore that otherwise wouldn't be heard because they weren't, you know, older dudes that worked kind of like in the Bodom and now and weren't really going able to tour. So I used it as a vehicle to be able to just help out my friends' bands at first. And, the first crop of bands had a band called Bring It On from Baltimore. And Everyday Dollars was a band from New York that featured members of like Killing Time and whatnot. And, just stuff like that. And Dark Side NYC, of course, featured members of Dark Side. That was the big kicker for me. I love Dark Side, so I was really excited about Everyday Dollars. And, from there, it just snowballed. It just kind of turned into, being around for so long and having just been involved with putting on shows and playing in bands, just get around and know a lot of people. So it was easy to put out records with a lot of friends, bands, and it just kind of snowballed from there and took on a life of its own.
That is, that's awesome. You seem to be able to do all kinds of things with this record. I recall watching a lecture that you did for Scion about releasing basically records in packages that diehard fans would really want. How did you get involved with Scion?
That came about from Dwid from Integrity. He was doing a lot of stuff with them, and I met Daniel Hall, who was one of the main coordinators for them at the time, and we just got along well and shared a lot of opinions of just about the whole. See what you want done and figure out a way to do it mentality. You know, a lot of people look at DIY as like a, hey, it's gotta be like, made from these sticks and twigs and nobody can help you do anything. But I always envision DIY as a way of making your ideas come to life, wherever way you can find to make it happen.
Definitely.
And so yeah, we all shared that attitude, something to it, that I agree with as well. So yeah, we just all got along swimmingly from there. And it just, again, it's always a, it starts off as a little pinhole and then just snowballs into what it becomes from there.
So speaking of Dwid, you're on the record as a diehard Integrity fan. How did you end up meeting up with him?
They're my favorite band, other than Kiss, who's my all-time favorite band. Integrity's like my second favorite band. But I've been friends with him for going on, I want to say 20 years, maybe, almost 20 years, like 21 years, I think. It was, I started getting in contact with him when Humanity is the Devil came out. And I've told the story a few times, but it's pretty funny. I've never actually told it in person. It was always in print. So just be able to put the emphasis on how annoying I was. It was like this teenager that a buddy of mine, this is like in the early days of the internet. It was before you know, as we know it, we're such a fixture in everything and we do daily. It was just, you know, this new thing. This was like when AOL would send CDs to your house every week and try to get you to sign into this thing called the internet. And
it'll never work.
It's just insane. Yeah, we're just like, what is this? It never work. It's like, you know, and then I'm like, it's like sending mail without stamps. This is crazy. It's like completely blown away by this thing, right? And a buddy of mine across town, he had access to the internet. And I would ride my bike, it's like 30 minutes each way. And I would go to his house and he was, you know, he was into music. He was very responsible for getting me into a lot of different things. It was my friend, Mike, who I called Goat Lord affectionately back then and still do. But he's actually a world-class baker now, but that's another tale for another day. So yeah, I would go to his house and we would listen to stuff. And we went on a very primitive version of the Victory Records website at the time. And they had this thing that was called like a real audio player. And it was just like horrible quality, like, you know, predating MP3s, I suppose, but just like really bad sounding samples of, you know, like the main bands on the roster at the time. And, you know, we're flipping through them and checking them out because we've been reading about the zines and none of the bands really stuck. Aside from Bloodlet, and Dead Guy, and Integrity. But Integrity was the one that hit home to me because it was just like, you know, having grown up a metal guy and like having a band that was so focused on riffs more than everything else, it was just fascinating to me. It was like this band that had these big Black Sabbath riffs and then these like punk parts that were in between. So I was like completely sold. And so from there, the big thing to do was to go into the city every weekend. We'd work our crappy jobs and then like spend our entire paycheck buying records and going to shows on the weekends. That was just like a routine. That's what we did every single week growing up. And I bought Systems Overload and was completely floored at like how just, it was insane. There was like solos everywhere. It had everything I liked about the song, the title track, which I had heard on that Victory Records player. And then from there, it was just insane. There was like, I liken it to a roach infestation where there's like solos everywhere. Like you lift up a cup and some solos spill out. You open up a book, some solos spill out. Like they're just everywhere. And I was like, this is the coolest band I've ever heard. And the vocals were just the meanest. Like it wasn't like a gruff, like beat you up kind of tough. It was just sounded like you swallowed glass. And it was like the harshest voice I've ever heard. So, you know, this was towards the tail end of Systems, right? When Humanity had come out. And we had got the Humanity CD as well. And inside there was an email address. So I was so excited. I couldn't deal with it. I rode my bike over to my buddy's house and I immediately just started punishing him with question after question about everything. Just like, you know, who's in the band? How did you write the song? How do you sound like that? What's the deal with this song? What's this song about? Just annihilating him with question after question. But not having the foresight to put it all into an email because it was all a new technology at the time. So I would literally ask a question and send it off and then go home, ride my bike the next day and hope there was an answer and there wouldn't be. I'd like send another question and ride my bike home, come back and wait for an answer and there wouldn't be. And I'm like, what is this dude's problem? Right? I was just like, bro, I was relentless. You know, every day I just be like, you know, more questions, just completely like just undeterred and determined. And then, I guess eventually I wore him down because he started writing me back. And, you know, we just got to talking and became friendly from there. And I was in a band at the time. It was called Day of Mourning. And we were recording a record at Mars, which is in Cleveland. And he had come out and did some guest vocals on the record, as well as Human Furnace from Ringworm at the time, which was incredible. This was like 1998. And this is for like a bunch of kids from Canada. Neither of those dudes knew, you know. So I had a few punishing emails on Dwid's part. And, yeah, they both like, you know, like kind of like it was like a dream come true for me at the time to be recording at Mars and to have those guys singing on my band's record. And yeah, that just kind of laid the groundwork. From there, we just kept in touch. Integrity was kind of dormant for a while. That was around the 2000 enclosure period. They weren't really doing much in the U.S. or Canada. They had never played Canada at that point. And yeah, once the Die For came out and they started becoming active again, I made it a point to go as many shows as I possibly could, see them. At the point before that, Ringworm and The Swarm were like my most seen bands that I've seen just the most amount of times in my life. You know, eventually I caught up and surpassed them with Integrity. And funny enough, on this Die For tour, one of the guitar players quit and I was going to join. But at the same time, my father was ill and he was about to pass away. And I was afraid that if I had joined, I would have to leave them hanging in the middle of the tour to go home and take care of family stuff. So I'm like, this just isn't going to work out. It's not the right time. So, you know, I let them you know, thanked them for the offer and went back to what I was doing. My dad passed away, unfortunately, but I did Pulling Teeth in the meantime and started 8389, which was cool. You know, I just kept myself busy. Then fast forward, you know, to many years later, and the opportunity came up again. And I'm like, let's do this. You know, I'll do this. I'll play some shows with them. And we got serious about writing a record. And that's how Howling came to be, pretty much, long story short.
That is fantastic. Sorry if I rambled on. No, that is a fantastic story. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. You mentioned the solos coming out of solos coming out of everywhere. That was kind of the thought that I had listening to Deathly Fighter, the Randy Uchida group cover song that you guys did pretty recently. How did that cover come about?
Just, you know, Gizem and that Randy Uchida group single is just unreal. It's just like Dwid's been like pushing it on me for forever, and same with Gizem. And, you know, admittedly, at first, when he was first showing me Gizem, I couldn't wrap my head around what was going on. It was just so strange and foreign to me. It was like having Randy Rhoads in this really harsh, like, punk band that sounded like a really, like, weird lo-fi punk band with, like, another extreme style of vocals that are, like, extreme in the same sense that Dwids are, but, like, in a different frequency and range. It's a lot, like, gravelier and just, like, you know. And once it clicked, it was absolute genius. You know, it took me a minute. I'm someone that, like, if I don't understand something, it's like a puzzle box. I have to sit there and figure it out until I can understand and, you know, and wrap my head around a piece of music. I'm somebody that spends a lot of time obsessing over music. It's like my prime. It's the only thing I've ever cared about. You know, like, I was never into sports or hanging out and stuff. It was always like, you know, I like studying music and like seeing what, ripping it apart and seeing what makes it glue together. And just that Deathly Fighter song was unreal. The solos were awesome. And I loved, like, the chorus. The chorus was really catchy. And I'm like, imagine Dwid singing it. I'm like, you know, we should cover this. The opportunity for the Decibel Flexi had come up. And I'm like, we had, like, some loose demos at the time because we demoed for the Howling LP for about a year before we recorded it. There was, like, 20-ish songs that we recorded. I mean, that we had demos of before we decided what was going to make the record. So to buy time, we just did the Randy Uchida cover and put that out as a Decibel Flexi. We did that just over the course of a week or so. I recorded the music, and then with Joshy, our drummer, and then Dwid recorded the vocals, and Kevin mixed it, and that was that. It just came together just like that. I thought it would be a cool way to introduce this incarnation of the band.
Yeah, definitely. And also, I learned that apparently the band is pronounced Gizem. I always thought it was Gizem.
I used to think that too. Don't feel stupid.
Well, I will make sure that
it's a common mistake.
Make sure I never repeat that in public. Thankfully, we're not doing a recorded podcast.
Oh, my.
But, yeah, let's talk about this new record, because it is something else. Howling for the Nightmares Shall Consume was released just last week, and it is a fucking incredible record. There's so much going on with every bit of it. How are these songs written?
Thank you. You know, I'm glad I can explain it talking to somebody, because trying to put it in context in a like a email or, you know, written interview is much different. It's like it was a very strange experience. I hadn't played guitar. This was around, you know, my first daughter was born in 2010, and Pulling Teeth ended in 2011. And I tried to keep going. I played in Ilsa for a while with Joshy, who plays drums in Integrity now. And just, you know, I couldn't handle it with the responsibilities I had. Like, 8389 was super busy. Work was super busy. And the kids, my wife, I just couldn't do it. So I just kind of abandoned music, period. Which is the first time in my entire life I walked away from music, was to just, like, just be dad. You know, kind of like get a handle on things at home. And when the opportunity for Integrity came around again, I hadn't played guitar in like maybe 2 or 3 years. And it was just super nerve wracking for me, because I'm like, you know, I didn't want to suck. So I was like, You know, when the songs came back to me pretty quickly, it was like riding a bike. Once I was back on, I was back on. And I just slowly started putting together riffs. I would just have this little tape recorder, which is how I've written songs my entire life. Now it's a phone. I just, you know, sing things into my little phone recorder. But back when I was like a teenager and a younger man, I would walk around. I had like a little portable tape recorder I would keep in my backpack. And every time I had an idea for a riff, I would just like sing it into this tape recorder. So I still have like tons of tapes. Like, I have like just like archives of random song ideas. And, you know, it just kind of went from there. I started taking the best ideas and using that as a springboard. And I'd go over to Joshy's house every week And he has a like a set of electronic drums and a little recording program. And every week we would get together and we started it by, we had this folder that we called the Cauldron of Riffs because we wanted to have like a cool name. We're like, dude, we need to have like a cool name. And that, you know, Cauldron's always like the first thing that sounds totally badass. So we're like, okay, we'll call it the Cauldron of Riffs. And every week we would add, you know, we'd record like little shorts. We'd record like just a verse or just a chorus or just an intro. It wouldn't be an entire song. It would just be a piece. And eventually I just stockpiled all these ideas and I would listen to them in the car and I'd be like, okay, I sew this one to this one. It was almost like playing choose your own adventure. You know, you kind of like, so this can go to this one, but it can also go to this one. Let's try to put this one together, you know? And that's how the songs came to be. And just spent a ton of time. We spent an entire year writing it, an entire year recording it. And while we were recording it, I was writing the solos on the spot. So it was kind of like, it was just an entire organic in the moment process. I feel like when it was done, I felt like more like it was done to begin with and we uncovered it rather than we built it. I felt like it was like in that Exorcist prequel where there's that church that's buried underneath the desert. It's already like built and stuff, but they had to unearth it. I felt like it was that. I felt like we just it was there, it was in us. We just had to like kind of like dig it out and dust it off. But it just kind of happened. I don't remember the specific details as to what made what song happen, aside from a few things. It just, the whole record just kind of flushed itself out. It was really cool.
There's a couple of just like really amazing moments on this record for me, at least. String Up My Teeth might be one of my favorite Integrity songs of all time now, because it has that chorus with a tambourine and backup singers, and it's just like a righteous 70s classic rock jam, like put in this hardcore and metal universe.
We didn't want to box ourselves in with anything. You know, are you a Simpsons fan at all?
Definitely. I have a Simpsons tattoo.
Okay. Okay, now rewind yourself to, do you remember Night Boat?
Oh, yes.
When they're watching Night Boat, and in every episode of Night Boat, he like, Bart gets mad. He goes, ah, there's always a ravine or a fjord. He's always mad because there's like, every episode ends with Night Boat ending in a body of water to catch the crime. And I always felt like people did that to DWID, whether it was former bandmates, you know, no insult. I think everybody that's been in Integrity before me is incredible and it contributed a huge part. I don't mean this in a disrespectful way at all, but I feel like in the past with Integrity, as well as with bands that are influenced by Integrity, they tend to rely on the D beat mixed with a big riff formula that makes Integrity. It's an Integrity staple. I Am the Spell is from the new album, totally pays homage to that specific sound. I feel like no one ever really wanted to expand beyond that. Everyone wanted to kind of keep Integrity boxed within this this framework where, like, I felt like DWID's voice was so dynamic, it should be like, we should try different things, you know? And he was really into that idea and really excited about it. And that one came about from just our love of, like, Motley Crue and Rat and just, like, 80s hair metal bands, but also, like, your Aerosmith and your Stones, even your Danzig, you know? We just kind of, like, we wanted to have, like, a AC/DC, just like a rocker, like a straight, like an A chord based rocker song. And we just thought it would be cool to have a female backing singer. And her name is actually Monique Harcum. She's another American that's living in Belgium where DWID is. And she's done a lot of singing, actually. She's got a new video that just came out. It's really great. And she's excellent. Yeah. So when we did that song, it was pretty crazy. I had a completely different vision for the song than DWID had. Are you familiar? Do you remember that show 227 that had Sherman Hemsley?
I have not seen
it. It was
that.
It came after the Jeffersons. It was kind of like George Jefferson was like a preacher. It had all like these sweet songs in the theme song and stuff. And it was like, you know, like super gospel. And I was like imagining like super like choirs all over the place, like a church kind of thing, right? And I had a friend of mine come over and we sat around all night recording layer after layer in GarageBand of like fake choir voices so we could kind of orchestrate the harmonies. So we had like these insane, like angelic, like whole choirs, like, you know, of dudes and girl voices singing. And when I showed DWID, he's like, dude, that's not what I was thinking at all. I was thinking of more like a Aerosmith, Rolling Stones type thing. And
I got a Gimme Shelter vibe.
Yeah, totally. And, luckily, you know, all that work making the fake choir wasn't in vain, because when we got together with Monique, I was able to use some of those tracks as a guide to show her what we were looking for melody-wise. And it all worked itself out. But yeah, we had a two different versions of what that song was going to be. But that's just an example. And it's funny that you picked that one because we knew that one was going to, that and Seven Reese Muse were going to be the two weirdest songs. We called it the two, like, what the fuck, part of my English there, but, you know, what the fuck moments on the record where, those are two moments where people are going to be, is that a lap steel? Is he singing? And then is that a gospel singer? And we're like, one of these two records, one of these two deals is going to break the record for some people. But so far, everybody's like loved it. So it totally like kind of just went how we didn't think it was going to go. People, it actually went over awesome. We love it. So we don't care if everyone hates it. More power, you know, if everyone hates it, we'll laugh because we think it's awesome. But the fact that everyone likes it is pretty cool.
Definitely. I mean, in addition to that, I think one of the coolest bits about this record is Dwid kind of like crooning and kind of a Tom Waits, like just a gravelly voice style. It's just such a change of pace. I mean, there was that one track on Suicide Black Snake that kind of explored that as well, but it's cool to hear more of that.
Absolutely. And again, it comes back to the pigeonholing and the night boat and the fjord thing, where it's just like, you know, after being in the band as long as he has, like how many, and you know, people are going to say, hey, it's never going to be Humanity's the Devil. I'm like, well, listen, Humanity's the Devil. It's not going to get better than that. That's perfect. You know, I don't want to try to make a lesser Humanity's the Devil. That's already been done, and it's been done perfectly. All those records are, I love every Integrity record. I'm an unapologetic fan. But, you know, to me, I like every record perfectly for what it is. So I would never try to just say, this has got to be better than that. It's just, you know, every record's like its own entity. So I'm excited that you got to try new things on this one that he's never tried before, and that, you know, that he may have expanded on stuff that he's touched before on previous records. I think it came out awesome. I think it's his best vocal performance in forever. I think it's like just like tonally, his voice just sounds awesome. He really, really gave 110% on this.
I guess, I mean, Integrity is known, like, the template for metallic hardcore. That's what it is. But on this record, it seems like you've kind of hit almost every subgenre of metal. I mean, the record opens with, it sounds like black metal riffs. And then going through hardcore death metal and, you know, classic rock and everything in between. So, I mean, you're really shredding the entire way through. And I think that people... you know, if they haven't heard this record yet, they'll hear a bit of it on here. But what was inspiring you to put that shred up? Who were your guitar heroes?
For me, the biggest thing was my main point of reference are the three main Ozzy Osbourne guitar players when he went solo, like Randy Rhoads, Jakey Lee, and Zakk Wylde. To me, are like that's the holy trinity to me. Those are my all time favorites. That's, I think, everything. If you listen, sometimes my wife will hear me listening like Blizzard of Oz. And she'd be like, oh my God, I could totally see that you ripped that off. She's like, you know, she knows like, that's like ingrained in me. That's like, that's been my favorite since I was a little kid. So, you know, and then of course there's like, it's such a, like a loaded question. I can go on for days. Like Uli Roth from the Scorpions is one of my favorites. One you don't hear often, but I think is incredibly underrated is Ernie C from Body Count. He's like one of my all time favorite guitar players. He has this really cool way of, just making his solos sound really sad, but really hopeful at the same time. It's just really cool, really unique. I can always tell that it's him playing, and I just really admire that. And, oh, man, I can go on for days, dude. Mick Mars, just everything. That's anything. I'm a person, and that's why the record is the way it is, how you were saying, how it jumps from, like, you know, style to style. It's I like everything. I'm, you know, I grew up as a metalhead, but I'm not – I listen to every kind of music constantly. I'm just always feeding my brain new things, and just so everything, you know, everything that I've heard in my life has somehow made an influence. But for me, you know, those Aussie guitar players and like Uli and Ernie C and Kirk Hammett, you know, I just go on forever. There's so many of them,
and I think it really, you know, it all pays off. It shows and it pays off. For folks that haven't heard this record yet, again, we'll hear a little bit in just a minute, but I think this is going to blow a lot of minds.
Thanks, I appreciate that.
So, you know, you're running the label, you're a family man. Are you going to be able to tour along with this record?
Sadly, no, I wish. We actually, we just did a little short tour over the summer in Europe, and that culminated at Hellfest, and it was such a blast, like, you know, everyone in the band gets along great. It plays really well. Just the band sounds awesome because it just sounds great. And but you know, my work commitments, and you know, I rely on A389 slowed down a bit because of Integrity. It's like juggling so much, something had to take, you know, the back seat, and I had to, like, you know, figure it out. And my you know, my main job is my priority, because you know, puts food on the table for the kids, and it gets health insurance for my family and whatnot. So that's always got to be first. And so we just approach it like, you know, and Dwight's in the same boat. You know, Dwight's got a family and he's got a career, and the other dudes have jobs. So we approach it where it's just like, we just play when we can, which is often, you know, we do all right. We get around, we play festivals, and we do, you know, like weekends where we can, but we're not a band that's going to be like, you know, road dogging it all year. It's just not in the cards for guys like us.
So, I mean, we like to ask it of pretty much everybody that comes on the show, just because it's cool for people to share this with us. What is your main gig? What is your daytime job?
I work as a engineering assistant. Yeah, it's a pretty cool job. It's when people have development projects that are for new developments, whether they're commercial or residential. We just push a ton of paper, man, and get it so people can build what they need to build.
Hell yeah.
It's cool. It's interesting. It's fun. I like the people I work with. It's a cool experience. But yeah, so I've been lucky with that. I kind of just fell into it, honestly. But luckily, it's given me a career that I've been able to provide for my family. And along with music, you know, music's always, whether it's A39 or playing at bands, it's all like kind of works hand in hand. And it's just kind of creating the day-to-day for me.
That's awesome. I want to apologize. I've been so stoked to get this information out of you. I've kind of been stepping all over Jordan.
It's okay.
Jordan, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I'm here too on this interview. Hi, everybody.
I'm sorry, man.
It's all right. You mentioned that A389 had formed in 2004, which was kind of like the height of the popularity of like hardcore, metalcore, metallic hardcore. There was, I mean, the U.S. version of Hellfest, Furnace Fest, Victory Records was still going strong, Trustkill Records, all that. Where do you see the hardcore scene now in 2017?
Oh, man. See, it's funny you mention all that stuff, because in 2004 and A389 starting out was a completely different animal. Like, A389 became known for metallic hardcore and metal. But when it started out was when I was in this band Slumlords, which was fronted by Jeff Perlin, who sings for the band Breakdown. So it was much more centralized around when it first started. It was more of like a traditional hardcore, you know, the first few releases, the first handful, like maybe five. But immediately after five, it spilled off and started being like stuff like Living Hell and Pulling Teeth's first record. And, you know, it kind of like snowballed from there. So, you know, like that whole Hellfest world and stuff, that was kind of like out of my jurisdiction. I really didn't notice any of that stuff as it was going on. I kind of lived in my own bubble. But 2017, I'm even more disconnected, man. I'm just an old dude that plays guitar and listens to records and hangs out with kids. I don't know about what's going on in the hardcore scene anymore. I do know there's speaking on Baltimore's behalf, there's a great band called Queensway that are doing a lot of stuff that are, I see them getting out. One of them kids, his name's Patrick, used to come help and do mail order. So I'm really happy. It's there, man. It's like, I can say without sounding like a pompous know-it-all that as long as there's kids, there's going to be a hardcore scene, you know? And then, it goes like the kids carry it on. And when they're done, the next crop of kids are going to carry it on. So, There's definitely a crop of kids doing something cool with it. It's just, I don't know much about it beyond that.
I just pulled up Queensway's Bandcamp. I hadn't heard of them before, and under the supporters, the top comment is, got a black eye during their live set. Hard as fuck.
Yeah, and they're like the sweetest dudes. They're like totally unassuming, but that record hits really hard. They're a really, really good band.
Sorry, go ahead.
Good run of bands. Oh, no, I was just saying, you know, Baltimore's had a good run of bands, but please continue.
What are your feelings on hardcore crews?
Not really something I was ever interested in. It's never been in a crew, never really. I'm friends with some people that are, you know, interested in that kind of stuff, but it's not like my friendships with people are about music. You know what I mean? It's like if I see someone that likes being in a crew or whatever, it's not like I'm going to be like, hey, you know, tell me about the crew. It's just like, hey, have you heard that new Deicide record? Or have you heard, like, whatever? It's not like I don't... That whole realm of, like, gossip and crews and fighting isn't something that's of interest to me. I've always been a music guy. It's never been about any sort of violence or gangs or anything of that sort. You know, it's not, I'm not interested. I'm a dork that watches horror movies and works a normal job. You know, it's not really my scene or my world, but not the best guy to ask about it, I guess. I don't really have much insight for you.
What are some of your favorite horror movies?
My favorite of all time is the Amityville Horror. It scared the hell out of me when I was a kid. And
have you seen all of those or because I,
oh, absolutely.
Okay. I know I saw one on like UPN when I was a kid, where a guy shoves his hand down a garbage disposal to fix it, and the house like turns the disposal on. Like, which one is that? Because I've been thinking about this for weeks for some reason.
That's like one of the, I think that's one of the later ones. Does that, how old are you? What timeline would this go in? Because I feel like it's, I know the first three.
I'm almost 30. This is, I feel like it was a haunted lamp from the original Amityville house.
Oh, okay, yes. I think, yeah, I know which one you're talking about. It's the fourth one. It's the one that comes after three. Obviously, Dirk is the fourth one, but it's the one with a garage sale where they buy the haunted lamp and they take it home. The Evil Escapes. I think it's called The Evil Escapes is the fourth one. And
fuck yes.
That one's kind of lame. It jumps the shark after the third one. I've watched the other ones just out of brand loyalty. But the first three are phenomenal. I know them like the back of my hand. But the Devil's Nightmare is a huge, huge favorite of mine. That's like right up there with Amityville Horror as one of my time favorite movies. It's just incredible. And geez, it's like guitar players, man. I can go on forever. Like horror movies and metal are my bread and butter. I could talk about it all day. But those are a couple of my favorites anyway.
8389, you know, like any good hardcore label, has put out a bunch of splits over the years. Do you think splits are still relevant today?
You know, I hear a lot of people don't like them for stuff that's as trivial as they don't know what band to file it under. Yeah, I feel their pain. It definitely is. If you like both bands, you know, you don't know what to file it under. But I personally have always loved Split 7-inches. I always thought it's a cool way to hear two bands or two bands uniting for a common theme. You know what I mean? We did a series with A389. It was like a Record Store Day series where I'd pick two bands that I think would go well together and have them record covers. Not of each other, just covers that they wanted to do. And then a friend of mine, his name is... I call him Simon because I cannot pronounce his name for the life of me. He's a friend in Poland. Simon, he's gonna hate me when he hears this podcast, but I'm gonna call him Simon. But he does a lot of awesome artwork for me, and I think it's Shimon. But the idea was two bands record a cover, and then my friend would design a movie poster, a full size movie poster, for a fake movie that was named after the two songs. So like the first one was Ilsa and Seven Sisters of Sleep, and they were covering Messiah by Hellhammer and The Fourth Crusade by Bolt Thrower. So the movie was called
I have that split with a giant fucking poster alongside it.
Yeah, that's it. And the poster was for a fake movie that was called Messiah and The Fourth Crusade. So then, you know, like there was a Noise and Occultist one where they covered Slaughter of the Innocent by Repulsion and The Damned by The Plasmatics. And that became a fake movie called Slaughter of the Innocent and The Damned. And like, so like it was a theme that we went on with. And to me, that was one of the funnest. It was just fun being able to just, A389 is much like my musical ventures and anything else I do in life. I just think of stuff I want to do and find a way to do it. So it was very cool to see those come to life. I think it's one of the label's crowning achievements.
That's right.
When I was getting ready for this interview, I was looking at the former roster list of bands that you've put out, and you know, obviously there's Primitive Man, Pulling Teeth, Ringworm, stuff like that. And then there was one that caught my eye, and I really hope that the list is true, and that's you put out something from Thor.
Absolutely.
That is 100%
true. When a good buddy of mine, when we were teenagers back in those days that I mentioned earlier, when we were hitting the city every weekend to go record shopping and go to shows, we would we stumbled upon a flyer for a Thor show that was happening in the East End of Toronto at the time, which is where I grew up outside of Toronto. But Toronto's where we would converge every weekend to buy stuff and hang out. And we went to this Thor show that was on the East End, and it was like in this really strange, almost mobster restaurant slash dive bar. There was all these dudes in suits with mustaches that looked like dudes my dad would have hung out with, and maybe like a couple of random metalhead stragglers, and that was it. But Thor put on the performance of a lifetime. Like, he was playing in like Madison Square Garden. It was amazing. And he totally took the time to hang out and talk to me and my friend Goat Lord, and and our other buddies that were with us. And it just made such an impression on me that that happened in like, I'm going to say 1998. And he never forgot me. You know what I mean? Like, if I went to a show, he always remembered who I was. I would run into him like every 5 or 10 years, and he'd always remember and always like pick up where I left off. So the time came for one of the 8389 bashes. We would have an anniversary concert every week where I would just put on these insane annual integrity shows with a bunch of awesome bands. And I invited Thor to come out, and Pulling Teeth was going to do a Thor cover set of my favorite Thor songs. And he was going to sing, and he was totally game for it. So we did that. We called it Thor's Teeth. And we released a record of that show, cause it was a professional like soundboard recording. It sounds excellent. And yeah, it's great. It's great hearing those Thor classics through Pulling Teeth glasses. Cause it's a little more, I want to say punked out a bit, where it's a little more, you know, less, rigid, and it's loose. It's fun. It's really, really interesting listen, and his banter is like just top notch. He's the best. I love that dude.
I really want to check that out now. My favorite thing he's ever done was the track with Seth Putnam. So I mean, definitely in line with the punk vibes. So that sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, he really is the greatest. He's such a underrated. Deserves to be huge. He deserves the world. He's the best.
This has just been a lot of fun for me to talk with you. Thanks so much for answering all of our fanboy questions here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. Thanks for caring.
Listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.